Hi, it's Patrick Cox here. You're listening to The World in Words, a podcast about languages and the people who speak them. And what's the most effective way, you think, to get people to drop their language, their native tongue, their culture, their view of the world, to drop that for another one? Easy. Send them to boarding school.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, and by PRI's The World.
Boarding school is perfect, much more perfect than Hollywood would have you believe.
Gentlemen, what are the four pillars?
Tradition, honor, discipline, excellence.
Banners up.
Welton Academy for Boys, a breeding ground for the future leaders of America. An institution dedicated to achievement, virtue, and conformity. A school whose rigid standards are...
The Hollywood line tends to be that, yeah, boarding school imbues you with values, but if you're a little bit rebellious, you can give as good as you get. You can teach the school your own values, right back at them. Of course, it's not like that in the real world. In the real world, boarding schools can be perfect ideological indoctrination centers. Not all of them are run that way, of course not. But if that's your intention, to indoctrinate, that's what you can do. It's like boot camp, except that the clients are younger. They're away from their parents, from everything they know. And you have them 24/7. Your rules, as harsh as you like. That's why boarding schools were used in the US, in Australia, in Canada, to effectively make Indigenous people white. On one level, these boarding schools, or residential schools, as the Canadians call them, they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. The kids learned English. They stopped using their native tongue. They wore Western clothes, cut their hair, converted to Christianity. Great! But the schools failed, too. And here maybe is where Hollywood inadvertently got something right about the boarding schools, though the reality is far darker than the movie version. Having broken the wings of those Indian students, the schools didn't equip them with newer, stronger wings. They just graduated them in their broken state. Most of these students didn't integrate, didn't thrive. They just licked their wounds. The strongest of them slowly rebuilt their lives, their identities. I guess you could call that rebellion. We're talking about entire generations of people here. So it goes beyond the individual. It affects bands, tribes, nations of people. And what now, long after the last boarding school is closed? What's the legacy of all this? And not just for the people who went through it, but for those from the dominant culture who now recognize that it was wrong to beat the language and culture out of people. Well, in Canada, they've been thinking a lot about this recently, and even doing stuff, changing things. That's what the pod is about today. Let me briefly introduce someone who's done more than his fair share of thinking about this, Ryan McMahon. He's a comedian, among other things, and he also hosts a podcast called Red Man Laughing. Here's a short excerpt from a live comedy special he put together with the CBC.
My name is Ryan McMahon. I come from Treaty 3 territory. I was born and raised in Fort Frances, Ontario. My family comes from Kuchiching First Nation. I'm Anishinaabe and Métis. Bonjour. Now.
Americans, that's Canadian humor.
Generally speaking, I need to start my live shows the same way all the time. I just need to clear the room of the awkwardness because it's there and I feel it. It's just kind of under the surface. I know I don't look native, okay? I know. You don't have to come up to me during the intermission or after the show and ask me for my status card. I get it a lot. I know I don't look like the native guy they cast in Crime Stoppers commercials, okay? I know that. I look more like the white cop that beats him at the end of it, don't I? A little bit of a fun fact, I've actually been cast in a Crime Stoppers commercial. This is the truth. In high school, I played the role of angry native youth confused by colonization, assimilation, and legacy of Indian residential schools, so resorted to petty crime and theft under 5,000 as a desperate plea for a hug. Yeah. Yeah. Now, the character wasn't really called that. I renamed him. But I nailed it, and it was fantastic. So we're going to ask you to take out your false teeth and get ready to laugh. It's time for Red Man Laughing.
Ryan McMahon. More from Ryan later in the podcast. Nina.
Patrick.
Have you ever been to British Columbia?
Victoria. I've been to Victoria.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Is that Vancouver? Or is that...
That is opposite Vancouver on an island, and I've forgotten what the island is. Maybe our British Columbian friends can help us with
Maybe
our bad geography.
I remember going to I was little. I remember going to a very fancy hotel to have tea. We had, like, English tea with little sandwiches.
This is coming back to me. Victoria is, like, more English than England.
Yeah, that's all I remember.
Yeah. Okay, so Alina Simone... Our friend Alina Simone, she went to a very, very different part of British Columbia. Nowhere near the ocean, but right inland. So very close to whatever the next Canadian province is, and also very close to the U.S. border. So that would make it in the kind of southeast corner of British Columbia. She was near the town of Creston, and she was there to talk to a tribe that is based there these days, though historically... They straddled the border.
In the U.S. so that you were across.
Yes.
There was no borders. Yeah.
Right. Their traditional lands were much bigger than they are now. That's where she was, and that's where she learned about this language.
Anne Jimmy is 68 years old and one of the last native speakers of Ktunaxa, a language isolate unrelated to any other on Earth. Until she was 5 years old, it was the only language she spoke. Then one day...
My grandfather told me that when I go to school, I was going to learn how to read. I couldn't wait to go to school.
She remembers getting in the car with her parents.
And I didn't really pay much attention, didn't realize that a suitcase was being carried.
They drove for more than 100 miles until they arrived at a huge gray building where they were greeted by a priest and some nuns.
And then one of the nuns came toward me and started talking to me. And of course, I didn't understand what she was saying. But when I looked, my parents were gone. They left.
For the next 8 years, St. Eugene's Residential School in Cranbrook, British Columbia, was her home. There were only a couple other Ktunaxa kids there, but...
The ones that, you know, would talk to me, they would whisper, because if you were caught speaking your language, you got punished. You got your mouth washed out with soap. You got spanked with a hard brush or a belt that was pretty wide and pretty thick and hurt it a lot. So you can imagine, like, I learned English pretty quick.
Ktunaxa, among many other languages, was pushed to the brink of extinction by Canada's boarding schools for Indigenous children.
I wouldn't even speak my language. I understood it. I remember my grandfather, the very person that told me and excited me about going to school. I remember telling him, "Speak English, I don't know what you're saying," which I knew what he said. But I was so brainwashed, and I know that he was hurt by that.
Years went by. Anne grew up, had children, and never spoke Ktunaxa with them.
I was suffering from all the pain, the strappings I got, the beaten out of me. But when you say what happened, it was that my language was beaten out of me.
Not quite. Though no longer fluent, when I asked Anne to recite some Ktunaxa for me, she chose a native translation of the Serenity Prayer, which begins, "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change."
Ninku nikin sasaka kunata hamatiktu kutsatsukut chunimu kutsatsukat kapsini kutskatat kuktkin hamatiktu tsmak kapmut kutskuktkin kapsini kutstakin aki hamatiktu kilkilwimut kutsatsukit upha.
The status of Native American languages has changed recently. In 2008, Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper officially apologized to the First Nation people.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history.
The government established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and paid reparations to people like Anne, who suffered years of abuse at the boarding schools.
These objectives were based on the assumption that Aboriginal cultures and spiritual beliefs were inferior and unequal. Indeed, some saw it, as was infamously said, to kill the Indian in the child. Today, we recognize that this policy of assimilation was wrong, has caused great harm, and has no place in our country.
So, Nina, I think it's worth talking a little bit more about this, about apologies and Truth and Reconciliation Commission and all of that. It's funny, I hear Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I think South Africa.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say.
Well, this one is a little different. It wasn't as powerful as that one. Like the one in South Africa, it granted immunity to anybody who testified.
Right.
This didn't do that. It was a somewhat different process.
Or,
the Canadians would say, process.
Process.
but it was a huge deal nonetheless. And it took 6 years to issue its report. The report came out just at the end of last year.
It came after Harper's apology, is that correct? Or what exactly prompted the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, before the apology from Harper, there was a class action lawsuit. And I hope I've got this right, but I think it was the lawsuit that prompted both the apology in Parliament and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Who brought the lawsuit to the courts? It was
People who had been to the residential schools.
Okay, from many, many different tribes. So it wasn't just like one particular
tribe.
Yes,
it was a massive class action lawsuit. It was the largest settlement in Canadian history. So part of the settlement were these payments, like the payment that Annie Jimmy received. But also a part of it was the setting up of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's funny. I mean, this commission was not ordered by the government. It was ordered by the courts.
So it took 6 years to research and write this report. What exactly was in the report? What did they find?
Well, they heard from all of these witnesses, and there was also a huge amount of new research done as to just how many people were affected by the abuses at the residential schools.
How many people were affected by the boarding school system?
Well, the official number, the official figure is 38,000 people, either physically or sexually abused.
Oh, jeez.
Virtually all of those abuses went unpunished. But the head of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission very soon afterwards said, that's just the tip of the iceberg, that 38,000, it's almost definitely exponentially more than that. It's just that those are the cases where there was a little bit of a paper trail.
Wow.
So there were 94 recommendations came out of this Truth and Reconciliation Commission for everything from saving languages to improving healthcare, education, child welfare, all of these broad sweeping things. And the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's the new Prime Minister at the time when this report was released, they have promised to implement all 94 of these recommendations.
So these are all just basically suggestions because
There's
no legal bounds to this commission. So basically they're all suggested changes, but Trudeau has promised.
They promised to implement everything.
To implement,
How they will do it is unclear yet, and that all needs to be worked
out. So perhaps there's money for language revitalization, among a lot of other things. What about the big question is land? What about land?
Yeah, big question, and nothing on that. That appears to be just a kind of third rail of these negotiations.
Right.
It's not like a bunch of tribes are going to suddenly get their land back.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
Oh, sort of makes an apology kind of feel like lip service. Although if the 94 other suggestions are taken, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a process. I mean, it does seem as though something is taking place in Canada that is bigger than in other places where they've done this. I mean, I don't know much about the U.S. I mean, what has the U.S.?
It's a heck of a lot more than what's happened in the United States. So when you told me we were going to be doing this, I looked up, I was starting to think, apologies, I know that there's been an apology for Japanese Americans who had been interned by the U.S. government during World War II. That didn't happen until 1988, and it didn't happen without a ton of lobbying, so it wasn't like the government was suddenly, you know, maybe we should apologize for that thing. And then, you know, the annexation of Hawaii, which took place in, like, 1893, there was an apology, and it didn't happen until 1993. You know, there's been a lot of talk about reparations for slavery, but it's all been talk. In terms of apologizing to Native Americans, there hasn't been any formal spoken apology. And the one apology, which was shocking to me, has come in the form of, like, a bit of language that was slipped into a Defense Appropriation Act.
Wait a minute. The U.S. Department of Defense, the U.S. military.
Right. So in 2009.
What kind of irony is that?
Right. So, yeah, no, really. Tucked away on page 45 of a 67-page document was a, quote, apology to Native peoples of the United States.
That's just so weird.
Yeah. No. So in December of 2009, this act was signed by President Obama. And nothing was really ever said publicly, not in Congress, not in the White House. Like, it's just kind of this language that's sleeping in this random act.
So wait a minute. So Obama signed this thing. What exactly did he sign? What did it say about what was the nature of the apology?
Well, I can read you a bit of it if you
yeah.
Quote, the United States acting through Congress apologizes on behalf of the people of the United States. Half of the people, not of the government, to all Native peoples for the many instances of violence, maltreatment, and neglect inflicted on Native peoples by citizens of the United States.
Citizens
of the United States. Expresses its regret for the ramifications of former wrongs and its commitment to build on the positive relationships of the past and present to move towards a brighter future where all the people of this land live reconciled as brothers and sisters and harmoniously steward and protect this land together. And there is also sort of in this apology a hope that the President of the United States will, quote, acknowledge the wrongs of the United States against Indian tribes in the history of the U.S. in order to bring healing to this land. But the President never said anything publicly, never read this. So the question remains, like, is there, you know, does this fulfill the resolution? Like, is this a true apology? And then, you know, this apology is the language is so couched in such a way. So, like, you know, it's not the U.S. government, so you can't really sue. It's the people, it's the citizens. It's like fault, no fault. It's
totally,
like very
totally.
Sneaky.
I could see why Obama didn't actually make a big song and dance about this.
Because it's not really an apology.
Yeah, why issue that sort of lame... Why would you publicize it any further by giving a speech?
Right. It's not leading to any kind of a truth and reconciliation committee. Certainly
nothing.
This language slipped into the Defense Act is not.
It's not part of a process.
But the U.S. is not exactly known for its robust apologies.
That makes me think that the Canadian version of all of this, I mean, that, I've got a little bit more respect for it, having heard about just how lame the U.S. has been. I asked a couple of Canadian friends. They all knew the day that Harper did his apology, whether or not the apology went far enough. Everybody in Canada knew about that apology. This was a big deal where, you know, school children, everybody knew about it. It was live
right.
on Canadian TV in the Canadian Parliament. There were a whole load of First Nations leaders in there with him. And it was the same when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission issued its findings. Again, the entire country knew about it. It was
right.
not buried.
Right. I mean, that's why when you said to me, like, oh, has there ever been an apology? I was like, huh, not in my memory. Like, I was like, I bet you that we've never apologized as a government, as a nation, to Native Americans. But I guess there's some weird slipped in language in 2009. Yeah, I mean, the question, though, that I have for you is, okay, the whole nation knows that there's an apology, there's this commission, but, like, what, in the end, does that, like, heal the problem? Is it just, like, the beginning of a whole, I mean, like, what does that do? What's the sort of purpose of an apology?
I want to defer here to Red Man Laughing in a whole series that Ryan did on this. About reconciliation, because it looks at the question from all different angles.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, with reconciliation and with an apology, if it clears the path at all for the next generation to, you know, take ownership of their language, of their culture, of sort of starting anew, and like how that might fuel the flame of language revitalization. I don't know.
Right. We don't know yet. But Lena Simone did also talk with, not just with Anne Jimmy, who lost the language in a residential school. She spoke with Anne's granddaughter, Jenny Jacobs, who had a very different experience. So let's go back to Alina.
Jenny Jacobs didn't grow up speaking Tunaha, but heard it enough to realize she was missing something.
It was kind of sad because I self-taught myself a little bit of Spanish and all these other languages. And then I was questioned, it was like, why didn't you learn your own language? It was like, I don't know, because I have people that speak it. And so that's when I started learning the language. I started looking at the words and started teaching myself it.
Today, Jenny is the language and culture teacher at Yakanuki, the Ktunaha Reservation School. And from the look of written Ktunaha, it's not an easy job. The language is peppered with glottal stops, question marks, apostrophes, scent signs, and a mysterious double-barred L. Jenny had to get creative to help students wrap their tongues around these unfamiliar sounds.
I'd start off like with their scent sign. It makes like a tss. And so it's like, so like, say cats. And then they say cats. And then it's like, what's the ending of the cats? And they would do the tss. I was like, okay. Then our barred L, that one was kind of fun. It was like, because I grew up with it, so I could automatically say it. They were kind of like spitting at each other. So that, and then I got to remind them, like, don't. Like, face away and then try, like, just try and do that. And then, so they did it. After a while, they got pretty good with it.
Who knew language learning could be a contact sport? Just a few years ago, it looked like Jenny might not have any students left to teach. The Ktunaha have been dispersed by the same economic forces affecting rural native tribes everywhere. And I mean rural. My GPS couldn't even find the reservation. As Yakanuki principal Karen Smith explains,
with the housing situation and the employment situation, a lot of families have moved off reserve. That really left us with not very many kids. When I started here 3 years ago, there were 19 kids.
And then something unexpected happened.
We have somehow caught on in the community, and we are a school of choice.
In just 3 years, enrollment has nearly quadrupled. There are now 74 kids at the Yakanuki School. The thing is, only 12 of them are Ktunaha. But all the kids are studying the indigenous language and culture, which ironically may just end up being what saves it.
The eagerness of the kids that are non-Tanaka is often even more so because it's something new to them. And all of the parents of our students really support the fact, and that's one of the reasons why they come here, so that they do broaden their awareness of First Nations and of the local language and culture and history.
Here are three of those students, Olivia, Dana, and Devenda, reciting the Ktunaha school pledge. I asked the three kids about their backgrounds.
And are you Ktunaha?
No.
No.
Both my grandparents are Ktunaha on both sides.
So only one out of these three, though you wouldn't know it from hearing them speak the language. Yakanuki may be rich in enthusiasm, but the budget for its language program is zero. School principal Karen Smith says, in contrast to the generous funding French immersion programs receive, there is no money available for programs like Yakanuki's.
Even after the apology and Truth and Reconciliation report, they just won't even put it on the table for discussion.
She is hoping that changes under the new Trudeau government, which has promised to increase funding. But for now, the school relies on elders like Anne Jimmy to preserve a language they were once forced to forget.
When I hear the language, it touches me. It really touches me. It makes me feel really good, you know, to know, to hear the language and to see these kids. And it also brings me back to my childhood, back when I was 5 years old, when that was the language I spoke. I get emotional. I get tears in my eyes when I hear the little ones singing a song in our language.
I was asked not to record any of the songs the kids were practicing the day I visited, ceremonial songs for an upcoming powwow. But a week later, Jenny forwarded me some modern covers from a CD called Ktunaha Pop that she and her grandmother both liked. Ktunaha meets the 21st century.
Alina Simone is a writer and journalist based in New York. So I said a bit earlier that I defer to Ryan McMahon of the Red Man Laughing podcast on the subject of reconciliation. Well, I want to play another excerpt from the fantastic series he did for his podcast. The entire series was on reconciliation. And sometimes in it, he's funny, sometimes he's wistful, sometimes he's morose. Here, he's angry. And you'll hear a reference to Sir John A. Macdonald. I had to look it up. He was Canada's first prime minister. Okay, here goes.
All right, to begin, I would like to ask a very simple question. Does Canada need reconciliation or does Canada need decolonization? Weird, huh? This is a rant about reconciliation. Why are you sidetracking? You haven't even started the rant yet, Ryan McMahon. Yeah, I know. If I had a truckload or a boatload or a mountaintop full of money, I would dump it directly into decolonizing this country. First and foremost, make this country look in the mirror and tell itself the truth. Can we do that just once? Can we do that? Or should we throw Sir John A. Macdonald another birthday party? Happy 250th, you old prick. Now, I'm going to get back on track, because we are talking about reconciliation. But without truth, there is no reconciliation. We've heard that said over and over and over again through this process, and I, for one, believe that. But what's the truth? Well, the truth is that the Indian residential school system was calculated. It was cold, and it was mandated by the government and the church in cohort. The truth is, I'm not even supposed to be here to make this podcast. Think about that. Really think about it. We are not supposed to be here. Had they been successful with their plan, we wouldn't be here. Full stop. Period. So when the government of Canada fights the TRC from start to finish, what does that tell us as survivors? What does that say to us when we full know that they don't have all the documents, that the government has withheld documents, that it was too expensive to produce the documents? They fought the whole way through, and I'm supposed to get over it. I'm supposed to reconcile. I'm supposed to round dance through the streets. Hey, way, way, ah, oh, hey, hey. I'm so sorry, Canada. I'm so sorry we're still here. But I hate to inform you, we're not going anywhere. Ah? I know, back on track, let's go. All right, we are being starved and pushed out of our territories. We are being given the handouts of a meager existence and made to feel bad for it. So the truth is, yeah, we're still here, but just barely. So if the government of Canada and if Canadians are serious about reconciliation, we need to be put back in our territories. We need the land back. Yeah, I said it. We need the land back. We at least need access to where we came from before this whole gong show started. Now, I don't know what it looks like. But I know that we need to be back out on our territories. It's where our health is. It's where the medicines are. It's where our languages are. It's where our histories are. And when we return there, we will rediscover who we are. That will bring us closer to health. But we're pushed out of our territories. There are towns and cities in our territories. When people inside of cities want to do ceremony, there's nowhere to have a sacred fire. So, there's a lot of things you, Canada, can do. And it starts with the land.
Ryan McMahon. Go check out his podcast, Red Man Laughing. It's great. I'll post a link at our site, pri.org/language. We're on Facebook too. There's a World in Words page. Also on Twitter, at LingoPod. I'm on Twitter, at PatriCox. That's PatriCox. Nina played the NEH funder that's coming up in a few seconds. She played it a couple of episodes ago. And I am asking you now to guess the accent of the speaker. Not just where this woman comes from, which I think is kind of easy, but also how long she's been in the US. Much tougher. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in early September.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, and by PRI's The World.